You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme: a peace treaty will be signed between FARC rebels and the Colombian government at the end of the month, but will the Colombian people accept it? Also ahead on the programme:
we do, of course, need to ensure that we get the best possible deal in relation to trade in goods and services. And I'm looking at this with an open mind. I think we should be developing the model that suits the United Kingdom and the European Union.
Britain's new Prime Minister says she is open-minded about forging new trade deals after leaving the EU. But how difficult is it to actually set up a bilateral agreement? And
it is made to appear as if I just signed a decree and said, I impose martial law on each and every one of you. No. I ask the legislature to please pass a law proclaiming martial law, because there was anarchy in the country.
Fernando Marcos imposed martial law on the Philippines for almost a decade. Why then does the country's new government want to give him a hero's burial? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, a senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck, the University of London. He's originally from Colombia. And we're also joined by Isabel Hilton, who's the editor of China Dialogue and has also worked as a journalist in Latin America. And I mention both those things because we are going to start in Colombia. Latin America's longest war will officially end later this month when President Juan Manuel Santos signs a peace treaty with Colombia's armed revolutionary movement, FARC. But that deal will still have to be ratified by the Colombian people in a referendum. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, how likely is it that this referendum will ratify the decision? Because it's not quite as straightforward as many outsiders would necessarily assume, is it?
It isn't. President Juan Manuel Santos seems to be convinced that the Colombian population will say yes. And those of us who have never seen a day of peace in our lives would hope that to be the case. But it has to be said that there are divisions. There is a division between rural Colombia and urban Colombia. Many urban Colombians, not all of them, but many have seen the war solely through their TV screens. And they're not as knowledgeable of the realities of war on the ground as those in rural areas. And there is also the division between those who, for one reason or another, seem to assume that the peace treaty is somehow victory for the rebels, which of course couldn't be further from being the case. But these divisions are there, and let's just say that the communication strategy rolled by the government has not been the best one so far. I think they're changing. I think they're getting better, but with the date so close, we must hope that Colombians decide in the best possible way.
Isabel Hilton, when you look at what's happening in Colombia with this peace deal and how it's going to be sold to the Colombian people, certainly from a UK and Irish viewpoint, you look at this situation and go, who's their David Trimble? Who is the leading figure there who was in favour of the war on FARC, who's in favour of a military solution, who is now saying, you know what, this is the time for peace? There seem to be very few of those characters.
Well, I would guess it's Santos himself, and actually pretty much that spectrum of Colombian politics is supporting him. The opposition on the political spectrum is coming from the former president Uribe, who is far to the right and supported, in fact, did a lot to create the far right version, if you like, of the FARC, who were the militia that grew up pretty much under his watch and took pretty direct action against the guerrillas, but also against people they suspected of supporting them. I think to support this, I mean, what's worrying for Santos is that the figures, the numbers are moving in the wrong direction. That in June, I think before the details were published, there was more support than there is today. And right now, about 50%, according to the latest polling, would reject the deal. And they seem to reject it on the grounds that the FARC are being insufficiently punished. They're not going to jail. There's no promise that people will go to jail. There is an element of justice, but it's more of the kind of truth commission justice where, you know, acknowledgement of the crimes, information is given, and people do not, on the whole, go to jail for a long time. And that seems to be a sticking point, certainly, actually particularly, as you say, for urban Colombians. There are also some very interesting, it's a 200-page document, and there's some very interesting stuff in here. So the FARC, how will the FARC conduct their politics from now on, and what kind of politics would they pursue? And I think that were this to prosper, were this to go ahead, you would see quite a big change in Colombian politics, more towards the kind of deliberative democracy end of things rather than the representative democracy that you have now, which has been, you know, frankly, quite troubled because of drug money, because of the divisions in the country, because of the war. And it is an opportunity to build a different kind of politics in Colombia, if only they can take it.
One of the challenges that supporters of this deal will have is that these peace talks have been going on outside the country, in Havana, a secretive enough place as it is, before you even get to the venue inside Havana, where they were sort of staying in some resort behind armed guards. And many will argue that they had to keep it that secret, and that sort of kept away from everyone else so that they could get on with the business of trying to thrash this out. But the flip side of that was they didn't really do much during that whole process of trying to sell it on a regular basis to the Colombian people.
That's absolutely the case. And as you pointed out, that's the biggest challenge. And on top of that, you could say that at least one of the two powerful media groups and television stations seems to be behind the No campaign, among other reasons, because there are some fears among some big economic interests that as part of the transitional justice process, they would have to disclose their own participation in far-right violence. And that of course, is a prospect that many of them would prefer to not to have to get involved with. So that's a problem. Having said that, there has been a lot of grassroots work, a lot of work at the grassroots level. Many of the communities which have been affected by the war are trying to make sure that those in urban areas who have not been affected by it know how it is and you know what it means. For instance, last week, very young Afro-Latino from the Caribbean area actually took it by himself to point out to Mr. Uribe Vélez in one of his no rallies why is it that the communities on the ground would prefer peace.
Isabel, in this referendum, there is a very clear answer as to what you are voting for if you vote yes. As you say, it's a 200-page document. You can read it all. This is the peace deal. This is what happens if we vote yes. It's a little less clear about what you're voting for, and I feel like we've had this conversation before about other things, if you vote no.
Absolutely.
Because the issue then of how to end the war, it becomes live again.
It is absolutely unclear. Now, the FARC are saying in the event of a no vote, they would not return to violence. They would stay at the negotiating table. But I find this, you know, I doubt it would be entirely straightforward. And there is, of course, a guerrilla group which has not been part of this process, a much smaller one, but nevertheless one that has not been included. So the possibility for at least the continuation of some degree of violence is very strong. And, well,
and even,
even
if there is a yes vote, there's no guarantee that 100% of parts of FARC are going to actually sign up to this.
That's true. But in addition, there are all those parts of the country and the economic activities that FARC controls. You know, what happens then if you say no? Do you then try, as the Colombian state, to recover those areas? That would be an escalation of the conflict. You know, the FARC actually, you know, holds quite a lot of Colombia and has run quite a lot of Colombia for quite a long time. So this is, you know, the peace process itself is a massively complicated affair, much more complicated even than in Ireland, where the IRA did not hold territory. FARC holds territory and has, you know, its own structures.
That's true. And in spite of the fact that it is more complicated than the Northern Ireland process, you know, what is being given to FARC in exchange doesn't go as far as it did in the case of Northern Ireland. For instance, there is no power sharing mechanism. There is actually a guarantee for six seats in three in the lower house, another three in the Senate for FARC during the first two periods as they become a political force, and that's it. So to turn that into some sort of impunity, we're giving the country away to these, left-wing Castro-Chavista is a complete exaggeration, and yet one that many people are going for. As you pointed out, there is no clarity whatsoever on what would happen if there is a no vote. And any time the question is put to those who are for the no vote, they refuse to say it. It's becoming a bit of a sort of a malaise in global politics, that you don't seem to be to have a plan.
You can say no, and then we'll work out later.
Exactly.
We'll come on to the other no vote, which led to which was based on little plan in a moment. I mean, one final thing, though, Isabel, just on this issue. Let's assume the signing all goes ahead and the referendum is won. What are the lessons that can be learnt from this peace process for when you look at other conflicts around the world? Do you think that there are either to do with how the process took place, the agreements on transformative justice? Are there things that you can pick up here you think actually these are good lessons for others to look at?
I think every peace process is, if you like, an iterative process. It picks up from processes that have gone before. There is a certain, and perhaps this is less helpful, I think there is a moment when you're likely to prosper, and that is to do with all kinds of things. It's to do with exhaustion. This has been a very long war. It's to do with the exhaustion of leaders. It's to do with a changing external environment. You know, would there be as much support externally for the FARC going forward as there is now? And there's, I think, also a willingness on the other side, you know, to talk. So first of all, you have to have willing parties on both sides, and both have to see that the prize that peace can deliver is greater than the prize they could deliver by winning a military victory. So I think those lessons apply in other conflicts, but I don't see many other conflicts that are mature enough at this point to embark on that process.
Okay, we'll move on. The United Kingdom, for the time being at least, is part of the European Union and, most importantly, the single market. It's the world's largest trading bloc and is worth trillions of euros each year to countries that are members of the EU. But as Britain prepares to leave the Union, government ministers here are hastily trying to arrange alternative trade deals in the event that it no longer has access to the single market. So how straightforward is it to set up a new trade agreement from scratch? Oscar, we have had various views, depending on which government minister you listen to and at what time of day as well. You get various different views as to what the next step for Britain will be. But it's become clear, even to many of those that thought it was going to be a walk in the park, that actually organising a trade deal is no easy task.
It's not easy at all. I mean, actually, it is very telling that the last thing we've heard is, oh, there's going to be a, you know, treaty between the UK and Australia. Incredibly telling. On the one hand, because I was on the tube and I saw a headline on a newspaper which said, Brexit will allow us to get cheaper Australian wine. well, we're already getting, cheap Australian wine, and why is it better to get, cheaper Australian wine than Spanish and French?
I want to pay £3.50 for my Jacob's Creek rather than £4.50. Brexit's a price worth paying if I get my cheap Australian wine.
Why is it better to get Australian wine than the Spanish and French wine? I don't know. We have to have that conversation. But what is the point here has to do with the fact that, putting together a treaty, as any, international economic lawyer would tell you, entails taking into account the fact that, for instance, investor protection clauses nowadays tend to be quite complicated and can be very tricky. If you're combining what these lawyers call offshore venues with alternative resolution mechanisms and forms of regulatory takings, in which if you're a country and pass a regulation, but that affects your investors' value, then you have to compensate. I mean, those things can be very tricky. That has been the case with NAFTA, which, for instance, the state of California has had to pay extraordinary amounts of money. So this is not just the little guys who pay. So you have to be very careful. And these processes tend to take between 3 to 5 years. So if we're talking about a treaty with Australia, who seems to be, a willing negotiator, they say that, there are some historical, forces at play here, which would make that negotiation easier. And still, it takes that time. Imagine how it is with others. That's one thing. The other thing is, when they refer to history, there seems to be this sort of nostalgia for empire. So as if we could back and, recreate those relations
those weren't trade relationships
exactly.
Britain had in the past. They were colonial relationships.
It's a very peculiar thing to refer to those, historical links as the Australian minister did.
Isabel, the Australian Trade Minister, when he was here in the UK, as we were saying, this was supposed to be the easy one. But even he was saying, well, look, actually, we're not going to do anything for 2.5 years because we can't begin negotiations until you've actually left the European Union. By the way, when are you doing that? To which he didn't really get much of an answer.
We go round and round in circles.
Nobody does.
I mean, it would be very nice to have some clarity from Theresa May on exactly what the destination is. But as we've seen this week, when her own ministers are disagreeing with her, or she's disagreeing with her own ministers, the people she has put in charge.
Yeah, this is, so process. David Davis yesterday
on migration.
He was speaking at the dispatch box for the government. The Minister for Brexit said he thought it was improbable that they could stay within the single market whilst also having controls on immigration. And within hours, the Prime Minister had said, don't listen to him.
He's only the man in charge.
It's only his opinion.
It is extraordinary. And I think the disintegration of the kind of magical thinking that the Leave campaign applied to Britain's future is only going to accelerate. If Australia, a friendly and well-disposed country, says, yeah, sure, but we're busy right now with the EU. So is everybody else. And Britain has kind of become that nuisance guest at the party. They've kind of, bleeding from a self-inflicted wound all over the carpet and kind of whinging that they need attention. People have other things to do, and this is a self-inflicted wound. The advice that's coming in from countries such as Norway and Switzerland, Switzerland took 25 years to negotiate its trade agreements. It's a very long and laborious process, and is also advising against adopting a Swiss model because it has all the disadvantages and none of the advantages. Indeed, many of the things that the Remain campaign were saying. And as the Leave people are trying to put form on this fantasy of Brexit, I think we're just going to see more and more of this.
Well, if you're about to go to university and you're not sure what to study, think of trade negotiation. You'll be in work for some time. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up next, why is the Philippines looking to give its former dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, a hero's burial? Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo, once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. Doesn't matter how long I'm here, there's always something new. It's a very, it's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. There's more to discover all the time. And also there's so much that's new in Tokyo. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on. So there's always something to keep us interested.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you're back here at Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Isabel Hilton and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. The former Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff, has left her official residence in the capital, Brasilia, for the final time. Dilma was impeached and removed from office last week after the country's Senate found her guilty of manipulating the budget. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, this is it for Dilma Rousseff, isn't it? There's no way back for her at all.
That seems to be the case. I had the opportunity to ask the First Minister of Scotland last week her opinion on this, and she pointed out that you know, women in power tend, you know, get a different treatment and tend to get punished you know, in a very tough manner, even if the basis for the accusation is false, as is the case in Brazil. This is a terrible blow for Brazil. You know, we were talking about self-inflicted wounds. Well, here you have one, and this is just the beginning. We saw two developments this weekend. On the one hand, you know, Lula da Silva and Patrus Ananias da Souza, very, very interesting figure in the Workers' Party, went together to, you know, to acknowledge the youth in Belo Horizonte who had occupied many of the squares and are pushing for an uprising in the country in order to, you know, force them to go for direct elections. On the other hand, in a more worrying development, we saw an increase in violence. I have received this weekend at least two or three letters from very, you know, very trusted friends describing the amount of violence that the police is exercising against those protesting in the streets. The protests are beginning to be reported in the media, not as well reported as they should, but certainly this is just the beginning, and the struggle will go on.
Isabel, Michel Temer has now supposedly 2 years in power with his all-male, all-pale government. Is he likely to get a chance to govern the way he wants to, or do you think, as Oscar's suggesting there, that there may be too many other pressures that prevent that happening?
I think he's going to be firefighting, honestly. He's leading a country that's whose economy is expected to shrink 3% this year. That's very big. I didn't see, you know, any particular remedy in sight in the short term for that. And in addition to that, and on top of the Lava Jato Petrobras mega scandal, news is breaking this week of yet another major scandal involving four pension funds and, again, pretty much the entire political class. So,
well, I mean, let's not forget that, you know, more than half of those who voted to impeach Dilma Rousseff are accused
liable for
in
corruption.
Some way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Of corruption.
Yes, so that in if you look at the impeachment of Dilma as an opportunity to restore faith in the political process and the political class, there isn't really a hope that is going to happen. Partly because he's not going to be able to deliver, but also because almost everyone he's associated with is implicated.
And also there is a question, isn't there, Oscar, for the Workers' Party, for the PTA? Because, you know, okay, Dilma Rousseff can't run again, but Lula can. And probably will, because he's the only person there seems to be that they're willing to put up. Where is the new generation of politicians? And again, let's be honest, politicians that are not tainted with corruption allegations, politicians that, you know, since it's called the Workers' Party, are still genuinely workers. They aren't there, are they?
You put the finger on a crucial problem. The Workers' Party needs to reinvent itself if it wants to come back in full force. Even sympathizers, strong sympathizers of the PT, will tell you that these big figures are also tainted, and that's problematic. And of course, we're going to see a huge effort by Eduardo Cunha and Temer and others to try and put as much dirt as they can on Lula.
So there's a reason for some of that dirt.
There are indications that there are problems there.
But the other thing is as well that this is a government that has, this is a party that has held the presidency for 13, 14 years now. It can be very hard to reinvent yourself in office, can't it?
Correct. So, which again explains some of what I referred to before. They're going back to the social movements to see Petros Ananias and Lula back, going back to El Horizonte, to the youth movement. They're trying to reconnect with those forces they had, for all intents and purposes, left behind and abandoned. That's the way they can, at some point, reinvent new leaders, but it's going to take time.
Okay, finally tonight, Fernando Marcos was undoubtedly a brutal man. He imposed martial law on the Philippines for almost a decade, had political opponents murdered, and amassed huge personal wealth at the expense of ordinary Filipinos. So why is the country's new government proposing to disinter him and rebury him with a hero's burial? Isabel Hilton.
Well, it's a funny old world, isn't it? But this is part of a long campaign of rehabilitation and part of the kind of longer struggle in the Philippines for control of the story. His son, Marcos's son, who goes by the unlikely nickname of Bongbong, is a close friend of the new president. And they have managed to block all attempts at recovering the approximately $8 billion that the Marcoses appear to have stolen. And really, in recent years, Bongbong has led a rather successful campaign to rehabilitate the name and the record of the dictator. And it's had remarkable success because it's got political support. Because in the end, you've got a political fight going on between the kind of roughly the Aquino, tendency and the Marcos tendency. And Duterte is very much in the mold of Marcos in many ways. He's an authoritarian character. He doesn't have a huge regard for the rule of law. He has drafted his own emergency legislation for use at any minute. And I think that, he sees no problem with Marcos's politics.
Well, and that's the other thing here, isn't it, Oscar? Because when you look at Rodrigo Duterte, or Duterte Harry, as some of his friends have been calling him, actually he sort of makes Marcos look not so bad.
In fact, that's what my friend Miguel Sihuko, the Filipino novelist, pointed at. That if compared with Marcos, what we have is a sort of 2.0 version, improved. Also, he seems to be kind of learning the worst habits of, the épaté la bourgeoisie right-wing populist in Europe and the States. So, for instance, calling the president of the U.S. names and so on and so forth. And that seems to go well with a sector of the population. My sources tell me that this also has to do with a similar problem, the lack of a new leadership. You have the same families, the Aquinos versus the Marcos, and you don't see, somebody new, something new in the horizon.
Just one thing quickly, Isabel, while we're talking about Rodrigo Duterte, he called Barack Obama a son of a whore this week. So Barack Obama decided that perhaps he wouldn't meet him.
You have to say it on the microphone.
I'm allowed to say it, it's fine. But what was interesting was that, unlike with his other quotes, let's put it that way, he rode back from this actually quite quickly, didn't he?
I think he was a bit shocked that actually, how many people can you offend at once? And after all, the Philippines is in a kind of confrontation with China in the South China Sea. The idea that he would insult the president of the United States, the Philippines has depended on the United States for its security for years. It's a bit crazy.
And I think somebody must have told them.
It was completely pointless, ridiculous.
Okay. on that note, we'll leave it there. Isabel Hilton and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serrer. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Benergi. More music next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. The Daily is back at 2200. Stay tuned throughout the evening for that. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.